Hello and welcome to another episode of Mere Fidelity, where we have conversations about life, theology, and the church in the world. And I'm Derek Rishmai, your regular host, along with most of the cast and crew, Matt Anderson and Alistair Roberts. But we do have a distinguished guest today, Charlie Camosi. He teaches theology at Fordham University, which is a big deal. And he wrote a book called Beyond the Abortion Wars, A Way Forward for a New Generation. So we had him on to talk because, well, that's already a fascinating title. So today we're basically going to be talking about abortion and his book. And because that sounds so broad, we're just going to say, hey, Charlie, why don't you tell us about your book? Set it up for us.
Well, first of all, I'm just really delighted to be a part of this conversation. It's one I've admired from afar, and now I'm glad to be a part of it. I don't know. The first question I ask in the book is, do we really need another book on abortion, right? There's been so much written. And I think the answer is yes, because so much of what's been written has really poor assumptions as starting points. And particularly in the United States, our assumptions are left over from the 1970s and 80s conversations, and as a subtitle of my book implies, I think there's a new generation of people who are having quite a different conversation with lots of different assumptions in play. The liberal-conservative binary, especially a secular liberal-conservative binary, isn't the starting place for many millennials. As Hispanics come into their own in this country, they don't even know anything about the abortion wars or certainly the larger culture war. So there's a real opportunity to do this differently. And I guess in the introduction and first chapter, I try to set up the sort of clearly conceptual space for that. And then the rest of the book, I really, well, in the middle part of the book, I guess the middle four chapters, I make a sort of straight up no chaser argument, philosophical, theological argument about what I see the major issues being. And then I finish with an actual policy proposal based on what I think follows from the new politics and the ethical arguments I'm making, which I call the Mother and Prenatal Child Protection Act. And I guess that's the fundamental, like, if there's a fundamental move in the book, it's to name our moment as one that refuses to choose between women and their prenatal children. I think that's not only the sort of right theological way to think about it, but it's also the way more and more actual real-life people are thinking about it, as opposed to sort of like the gatekeepers of the discourse that are still living in the 1970s and 80s.
So, okay, so Charlie, this is Matt, and before I ask my question and we dive into this, I appreciate you laying out what you're up to in it. And for listeners at home,
oh gosh, I forgot.
I have read, don't worry about it. I have read this entire book and have read a number of other books on the subject, and I will say that this is now the book that I will happily and cheerfully hand out to anyone who is thinking about the question of abortion, particularly as it pertains to public policy. It is far and away the best treatment of the subject, and it's accessible, and it's just absolutely marvelous. I'm a huge fan. So thanks for all of your work.
No, Matt, that's way over the top, but thank you.
Well, as readers know, I sometimes have, and as listeners know, I sometimes have something of a penchant for being over the top.
He's now on record. Let the record show. Matt has endorsed the official pronouncement.
That's right. But in this case, that works against me because I have a lot of superlatives that I would use of this book that I don't think are hyperbolic at all. It's a really, really interesting and illuminating and important treatment. Okay, so one of your can I just go straight to the controversial issue, the thing that I am most interested in?
Sure.
Some people think that abortion in the case where the child is threatening the life of the mother is not permissible at all because it's a direct killing of an innocent human life. Some people think that it is in fact permissible when the life of the mother is at stake. And this is one of the main questions that pro-life advocates get and have to deal with at a public policy level. Now, everyone on the public policy level seems to allow for or want to grant exceptions for abortion restrictions for the life of the mother. But the question is, how do you justify those kinds of exceptions within a properly and deeply consistent pro-life view? And your way of doing this is, as I understand it, this. And you can correct me if I'm wrong afterwards. The child who is threatening the life of the mother isn't performing any deliberate, conscious, willing action by doing so, right? So there's no question of justice or injustice with respect to what the child is doing. But she is, you say, materially a mortal threat to her mother's life. Which is to say, the child at that point seems to become something potentially, right? She's materially a threat to the mother's life, even if the child isn't willing or consciously acting anything. And I think my question is something like, does that remove agency from the child in the womb in a way that troubles you? And potentially, for children who are material aggressors, in one sense, dehumanize them?
Yeah. Boy, you went right for the jugular, didn't you?
Matt doesn't know any other lesser things.
This was the most interesting part. You make a fascinating argument here, and I am really unsettled on my point.
Yeah. Well, it's a controversial issue, and I really wish, before I will answer your question, let me just make a meta point about public policy and like politics and all that, right? Like,
yeah.
If we end up talking about this question in any broad, serious way in our public debate about this, we immediately lose the argument. So, like, this is not even, for almost everyone, this is not even a question. Of course you save the life of the mother. It's not even using direct abortion, you save the life of the mother. And even for most really hardcore pro-lifers that aren't Catholic that I've met, this isn't a question for them either. With a few exceptions, it's been sort of an inside baseball Catholic type argument, but not only. But so that being said, let's talk about the question I had. So I don't use the term innocent aggressor. I don't think it makes sense. I wrote a blog post on CatholicMoralTheology.com asking the question whether we should use the phrase innocent aggressor. And I don't think we should, actually. I've thought about this. I don't think we should. I don't think it makes sense, as you say, for a child without agency. It doesn't make sense to use even the word aggression to describe what's happening. But I do think it makes sense to say that the child is a material, mortal threat, as you said correctly, to her mother. And then I make analogies to other kinds of situations where someone without agency is a material, mortal threat. And I think this is what does a lot of the explanatory work for the argument I'm trying to make. I don't know if it ultimately works, but at least this is where I think I'm on most solid ground. So imagine you're a counselor, you're a psychiatrist, and you know a patient of yours is off his meds and completely insane and is now shooting up your waiting room, right? Are you able to use deadly force in defense of your patients or even yourself or your employees, knowing that this individual is acting without agency? They're innocent, right? Formally innocent, but nevertheless a material mortal threat. If the answer is yes, then I think you've established the principle that I'm arguing for, which is even though the individual is formally innocent, they're nevertheless a material mortal threat, and you are legitimately able to use deadly force in defense of yourself or another. Another example I use in a similar way is a child soldier. So say like a 6-year-old who has no moral agency with regard to what they're being forced to do, or at least not a culpable moral agency, innocent in that sense. They can also be a material moral threat. So all I'm really saying is what trying to appeal to our intuitions about those two cases, and then draw the implications from those cases to a case where a baby threatens her mother's life, a horribly tragic case. I absolutely think we should use indirect abortion. This is the church's teaching, right? We should use indirect abortion if we can. There are very, 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 very rare circumstances where it looks like you might need a direct abortion to save them their life. And that's what I'm talking about here.
In those parallel cases, there is a so I think people have so let me try to defend the really, really extreme case, because I think I'm persuaded. I just want to say I think I'm persuaded by your analogies and the way that they're functioning here. But they are different in the respect that even if like the person with mental instability or you know who is properly insane, who's shooting up people, even if they don't have control over their rational faculties, they are acting, right? They are doing something in the world which extends beyond sort of their natural course of development. A child who is a material mortal threat to the mother is not acting. Even in that sense, it's not just that they don't have rational control over what they're doing. It's just that by chance, by terrible luck, they have the course of their natural development has gone awry in such a way that their simple existence is now a threat to the life of the mother, regardless of whatever else they do. Does that something seems like it hangs on that difference for how we conceive of the how we should respond to the mortal threat? Potentially, and it just even in the sense that we would acknowledge and respect even a tragic providence.
Yeah, I don't. This is exactly the right place to press me, and I have been pressed both online and in person on this point. And I guess my response is something like this, with two responses. First, I wonder if at least the traditional moral theological position, which is, oh, the reason you can use deadly force is because the individual's not innocent, right? You can never. According to traditional moral theology, you can never aim at the death of an innocent person for any reason, and I agree with that. I strongly uphold that, believe that with all my heart. And
Good enough.
the it really doesn't that doesn't work with the cases of the child soldier and insane person, right? They are innocent in the relevant sense, in the sense that their wills are innocent. They're not morally guilty, right? Well, the move I'm making in the book is to say that's not all. That's not the only relevant sense of innocence that's involved in making the judgment to use deadly force. It's also material innocence that's important. In fact, the word innocence, interestingly, etymologically, the root is not noxious, right? Not harmful. And I find that fascinating. And I think that's where a lot of our intuitions lie. And I don't quite know. I mean, I guess I kind of share your intuition that, well, there's an act here, but I don't quite. I mean, maybe the lazy binary of like a willed action versus a not willed action, it doesn't help us, is not helpful, because there's all sorts of like middle ground positions, middle gray area positions. Like, so if somebody sleepwalks or like even rolls over in their sleep, is that an action that's relevantly different than, say, growing in the womb? If someone is insane and doing something without, with that, or even on drugs, right? Or like, there's clearly their agency is not what is resulting in their like physical movements, right?
So I'm probably not gonna have much more contributions, but this is partially why I was a philosophy major and I used to love these kinds of discussions, was the analogies. To be honest, it's the best part. So trying to think along that moral culpability without doing anything immoral, but still going to result in harm. I think of Terminator 2. This is just where my mind goes. Terminator 2.
Terminator 2.
Okay. So. No, there's just a lot. There's a lot of interesting paradoxes there. So spoiler alert from like 20 something years ago, if this is a shock to you, you are morally culpable for not having seen this, but so
I haven't seen it. If you're at home and shocked, you've got company in me.
You are terrible. Okay. That's, we might need to intervene right now. So Connor, Sarah Connor goes back, and one of her things is she busts out of jail, or they get her out of jail and all that kind of thing. Her move after finding out all the Terminator story is to go find the scientist who will one day use the technology that will, you know, turn into Skynet, which is the, you know, the artificial intelligence that eventually takes over the world, destroys almost everything, and results in the war. Now, this guy is just a scientist working on technology to create better computers. He's not looking to do anything. He will, the choices he makes by just doing his normal, morally neutral, even good job, will result in the war that will destroy the world. And so her move is to go shoot the dude. That, to me, I don't know, I started thinking about, in a sense, that's to me, that starts to constitute a bit of a parallel with the, by just being there, by just doing non-moral or possibly moral activity, the man constitutes a threat to like all of human civilization. Is Connor's instinct, I don't know if that's a parallel or it was just a way to work Terminator 2 into the...
No, it's interesting. As I realize where you're going with this, I got a bad feeling in the pit of my stomach, so I wasn't sure how I was going to respond to where you were going.
I'm just posing it. Does that, I mean...
No, yeah, well, I mean, it poses a problem, because I don't think you should be able to kill that dude, right? Can I respond with another analogy? Since you,
yeah, it's cool. I love analogies. Can you work in Terminator 3?
Fortunately, this is not a movie that I know of. Anyway,
all right.
So I mean, that's a fantastic analogy in the sense of like it will never happen. But here's another one that's maybe a little. It is fantastic, but not quite as unrealistic. So imagine you're carrying a flagpole, or like a small flagpole with a flag that has a very sharp edge at the top, you know, like one of those pointed edges at the top, and someone has slipped off the roof of the building you're standing right below, and they're going to fall on you, right? They're going to fall on you. You have a split-second decision to make. You can use the pointed tip of the flagpole that you're holding to deflect them, will essentially impale them, right, with that. Or you can let the person fall on top of you, right? Now, clearly, they're not even active in no sense, not even in a sense of growing, right, like as a baby is doing inside a fallopian tube or something. Are they acting, right? They're just, they slipped and fell, or maybe they were pushed, or you even call it that way. Maybe they were pushed. Can you use the tip of the flagpole, essentially, to defend yourself against the material mortal threat of their body falling on top of you and crushing you. I think you can. That's my intuition. I guess maybe that's, the more I study ethics, the more I just am convinced so much of this is about intuition. But my intuition is that you don't kill the guy that's going to produce Skynet, but you do defend yourself against the material mortal threat that's falling on top of you there. I don't know. Does that help in terms of like the kind of distinctions that we want to make? I don't know.
Yeah, I just...
Perhaps another example would be if you're climbing a rock face and someone was connected to you and they had some sort of blackout and lost their grip and were just hanging down and the rope was holding you down and there was no way you were going to escape the situation and they weren't coming to consciousness. What do you do in that situation? If you carry on as things stand, you will die and they will die. In all probability. But if you were rescued, I mean, their life is viable if you weren't on the rock face. But do you cut them off from you so that you can continue to the top?
Yeah, that gets us into really complicated questions of action theory, because I'm going to want to say, though, this is, people will challenge me about this, but that's not aiming at death. So even if you foresee but don't intend that they will likely die from falling against the rock, you know, 40,000, you know, what, I don't know, 2,000 feet or whatever it is. The act of cutting somebody loose from you is not the same as, say, crushing their skull in a craniotomy or piercing them with a flagpole, which by its very nature, the act seems to aim at death, which is prohibited, at least in my understanding of moral theology. So that's, some people who have different action theories, they'd say, no, there's just no difference between cutting somebody loose from you, they fall 2,000 feet, versus, like, you know, crushing their skull. It's the same kind of act. But so the way I understand at least Catholic moral theology is those would be two different kinds of acts.
See, that reminds me of J.J. Thompson's old article on the, you know, the violinist.
The violin player.
That article is just still so, I mean, it was wrong in certain ways, but that was still just such a fun article. So many analogies. Again, I feel like one of the examples she had in there was like a directly relevant one, but it's been forever.
Well, I mean, yeah, and it's that article that sets up this discussion in Charlie's book. Because everyone has to say something about that article, right? It's the most commented on article or most republished article.
Yeah.
I think in the history of philosophy.
Maybe.
Yeah, it's in so many undergraduate classrooms for sure.
So, Alistair, we've gotten off on these analogies, and that's my fault.
That's like the one thing you did that isn't morally culpable. In this whole thing, I'm just still so mad about you not watching Terminator 2.
But there is, I mean, one of the public policy, what hangs on this for you, Charlie, in terms of public policy is, people taking RU486 if they've been raped, because the rape situations are the other situations which always come up in these kinds of conversations, right? People just want to throw the hard cases at pro-lifers and say, you know, what about this? What about this hard case? Kind of like what I've done to you.
And you're going right to number two.
but it's a straight line from framing the child as a material mortal threat to saying women who have been raped, in some circumstances, it's permissible for them to take RU486. Am I right in understanding that in terms of what hangs on that?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure. if I've been totally clear about the connection between the two. I don't think that it's the same kind of argument, because I don't think you can aim at the death of an innocent person and a child who is growing in her mother's body as a result of non-consensual sex is an innocent person. So I don't think you can do a direct abortion in the case of rape, period. But I do think that indirect abortions are different kinds of questions, morally speaking. And this is where Thompson's analogy, I think, is actually helpful. Removing yourself from the violinist, right, is different than taking a short sword out and hacking the violinist to death.
And just, can you just say the violinist case for listeners at home who maybe don't know Thompson's article?
Yeah. So in a classic example of 1970s philosophy, it was a thought experiment about sort of a person. Imagine you have a very rare blood type, essentially, and also you share this rare blood type with a very famous violinist, and the Society for Music Lovers kidnaps you until they can find essentially an organ or a vital organ, like a kidney or something, for this violinist who needs it, but needs to use your organ. So you got to suspend disbelief, right? Well, actually not too much today, but like back then you certainly would have had to suspend disbelief. You know, essentially, can we use your kidneys for 9 months, use your body in some sense for 9 months until we can find, you know, a new kidney or other organ for the unconscious violinist. And as she's meant, through the Travis Thompson made this argument as an analogy to abortion. She thought, well, and again, she's trying to appeal to intuition. Like, well, of course you can disconnect yourself to the violinist. You don't owe the violinist your body. But as many people have pointed out, it's totally disanalogous to direct abortion, because that's not what happens in direct abortion. And that's actually not the aim of the act in direct abortion most times. Simply saying, I don't owe you my body. Often what's being done is aiming at death, both physically and by intention. But even the Catholic Church would say indirect abortion, where you're just simply removing yourself from the child, is a different kind of act. So the Church would say, so you can do a hysterectomy with the child inside the uterus if there's cancer of the uterus, right?
Right.
And the way that the moral theology works out is you need a what's called a proportionately serious reason for doing that. And it's a very different kind of reasoning than the reasoning against always killing the innocent, which is just straight up, you're done.
The other disanalogy that I thought was important, so I remember reading that and I thought it was an interesting, you know, argument. Obviously everybody does, but the fact that in those cases, in most cases, you know, you're hooking yourself up to the violinist with every, or potentially hooking yourself up to the violinist with every sexual act. And I thought, if anything, the only thing that it's actually kind of analogous to is precisely the instance of rape. So that the moral, in a sense, attaching yourself, obviously in the case of rape, that clearly isn't happening. You're not, I mean, that is the situation where you're being kidnapped and attached against your will with no moral, in a sense, responsibility of having engaged in the kind of activity that will result in you being attached to somebody. That article was the one that kind of made me think in the case of rape, something like indirect is morally permissible, because it's partially because of just, it's a different, I don't know, in a sense, the situation that led to it was of a different order. Then again, I'm not trained in fine-tuned Catholic moral theology, so.
Well, lots of people disagree with me about this and have already and will disagree with me about this, but I agree with you. I think, I don't think you, anything close to like the idea, like somehow this gets cast as sometimes it gets cast as thinking that babies born as a result of rape don't count the same as babies that aren't, and that's just false. They're exactly the same value. The question is, what is the duty of a mother to stay attached and support that child, right? And I think it's a stronger duty, as I argue in the book, it's a much stronger duty than someone has to stay attached to the violinist, because that's the mother of the child, and we don't choose our responsibilities to our children and to our parents are not chosen responsibilities. We know this, right? But I still think sexual violence is at least something that could be considered a proportionally serious reason in certain circumstances for an indirect abortion. And in some ways, you know, I'm glad to talk about these things, especially with smart people like you who are interested. But in other ways, I feel like that the focus is too much on these cases because they're so rare in the million plus abortions that are done in the United States are just unbelievably rare. The overwhelming majority of abortions are in other cases. But unfortunately, our politics is such that, as maybe you know, the 20-week ban in the United States is being held up right now precisely because they're trying to get the sexual violence exception language right, and or at least palatable. And so it's unfortunate that we have so much attention to such few exceptions that involve such few cases relative to the other number of abortions.
Yeah, on and that just point, to be clear, I was wondering if you could.
Can I issue a Matt-like statement? I'm for the record, I'm still parsing that whole exception issue. So if people on either side are writing in angry mail, I'm still weighing that. All right, now I will resume. Not being Matt. Hey, Alistair.
I was wondering if you could comment on just the contingency of the current debate within American society in particular, but the West more generally. It seems to me that much of the debate that we're having is shaped by a particular Western liberal tradition, by its position within a particular historical moment. And as you say, that historical moment has changed from the 1970s and 80s. And the debate will take a different shape now than it has done in previous years. I was wondering if you would comment upon, have you given any attention to the shape that the debate has taken within non-Western societies about abortion, or how the issue has been framed in very different historical contexts, and how might those be informative for us in understanding just how contingent our particular debate and its shape is?
Yeah, I have some thoughts on that. It's not my area of expertise, but one thing I do have some interest in and have read up about and have talked with people of different cultures, non-Western cultures, about is a sort of neo-colonialist approach to sub-Saharan Africa and their reproductive practices, right? And just the uncritical knee-jerk reaction that a lot of privileged white people in the developed West have towards exporting our practices in their direction, particularly contraception, but also abortion. Unfortunately, Amnesty International and other places really, really push these practices. And a lot of Catholic bishops in these countries are very, very strongly resistant and use the neo-colonialist language and use the critique of Western consumerism and say, you know, we don't need the tools that you have been using to enable, among other things, a kind of consumerist culture that we don't want. You know, we need wells dug and seed fairs and protection for our women from violence. We don't need abortion, right? We don't even look at it through the lens of individual autonomy and choice and freedom and exerting your will on the world. That's not even the kind of framework we have. And more, this is actually not only a critique, as you implied in your question, I think, a critique of just non-Western peoples, but of increasingly people in the developed West saying, we're challenging the consumerism inherent in our reproductive practices. We're challenging the notion that somehow individual autonomy is the primary value, the primary lens through which we look at value, particularly in bioethics, but even more generally throughout the culture. And I see that happening with my students, my millennial students in particular. They're challenging the presuppositions of Roe versus Wade and its successors, particularly in terms of its anthropology.
Charlie, can I ask you an unrelated question? It's not as hard as the previous ones, I don't think. I spent some time at my local CareNet center, pro-life group, crisis pregnancy center here in Waco. And one of the things, and I hope this doesn't get them in trouble at all, but one of the things that they said in their training was that in the counseling room with girls who come in who are considering abortion, one of the things that they do is they use incredibly clinical language. So they don't talk about the baby. They talk about the fetus because these women are scared. They're terrified about what this means for their lives. And language of the baby increases their fear and their anxiety, and it makes it harder for them to reason out what they should do, and makes it harder for the counselors to reach them, to be honest. It was a really interesting and illuminating point for me, and not something that I'd ever considered. How much do you think there is a tension between our public rhetoric about life and its sacredness and so on, and the kind of anxiety that women who are at risk feel when they experience unwanted pregnancies? Are we like unintentionally, by defending this good, making it harder for the very people that we would want to reach to consider our ideas because of our rhetoric? Have you thought about that side at all?
I have to say I haven't, but I didn't know that. That's a fascinating data point for all of this. Again, this is the first time I've been confronted with it, so I don't quite know how to respond, but one just very quick response that I have is, I wonder if there's a difference between the rhetoric we would use for a understandably freaked out young woman in a CareNet facility and just how we talk about sort of what it means to have justice in a culture for our most vulnerable populations.
I think that's a very relevant point. Because in the public square, the language of fetus it serves a dehumanizing function. It serves taking this category and putting it out of the realm of shared common human. It places it in the not yet category of humanity for most people. It's like you have to reinforce very strongly in the public square and in general conversations that this is a baby, this is an infant, even though in the particular counseling session it might serve a calming function. I really dislike seeding fetus language in public discussion about these things, because it is so easy. It just, like, even the way we talk, you see it on TV shows before the girl decides, you know, it's, are you going to keep it, this or that, and then finally it becomes a baby. Sorry, I just had to.
Right. So I just want to be clear. I totally agree with those concerns. And which is why I was so taken back by the unintended effect that it might have, but it does make me reevaluate how pro-lifers speak in public and particularly the kinds of whether our rhetoric has been properly attentive to the crisis situations that we're trying to prevent and how it needs to be shaped by those crisis situations. And one reason why, Charlie, I think your book does such a great job is because you definitely don't. I mean, I've pushed you to on some of those harder issues, but you've got an attentiveness to the complexities of the issues and the complexities of the questions that seems just more sensitive rhetorically to the kinds of challenges that women facing these decisions and men who have impregnated women facing these decisions actually have to work through. And sometimes I think, like, if nothing else, it seems to me like good philosophy, careful, rigorous, analytic thought, like you're doing here, has a therapeutic, practical value, even if it diminishes the kind of rhetoric that pro-life activists like to use. Like, this book strikes me as the kind of thing that I would hand to someone in a crisis situation, precisely because it's plotting, it's analytic and critical. And when they're freaked out, it turns out that's what they actually need, rather than lots and lots of strong rhetoric that's gonna be hard for them to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, that's, if I could clap, I would. I mean, that is a lesson that the pro-life movements, the activist pro-life movements, need to hear again and again and again and again and again. And sometimes I wonder if the pro-life activist movements, many of them have lost sight of what their actual goals ostensibly are, right, which is saving the lives of babies rather than trying to win rhetorical wars with their opponents, right? And often the very issues you raise get lost in trying to win rhetorical battles with their opponents. And that's frustrated me about the many aspects, not all, right? The pro-life movements are very diverse and there's lots of different ones. But I think that particular point you just made needs to be made again and again and again and again.
Reading your book, there are a couple of...
We're just going to take what I said and put it on repeat then. We'll just loop it over and over. Just kidding. Sorry, Alistair, go for it.
Reading your book, there are a couple of things that really struck me about it, about the broader way that we approach this debate. The first was that in a debate that has generally been dominated by polarizing absolute principles, life and choice and these sorts of things, you seem to be emphasizing the introduction of more prudence into the debate. The other thing that I was struck by is the role that you almost provide this wide-angle lens on the issue, as opposed to this piecemeal focus upon abortion detached from the larger social fabric within which that issue lies. And so maybe within the context of a Catholic social theory, its emphasis upon the seamless garment of justice within society. Do you think that this abortion debate can be used as a sort of pedagogical moment for Christians more generally in their engagement with cultural and justice issues within the society? And if so, what are some of the key things that you believe that it can that we can learn from this debate?
Yeah. Thanks for setting me up with a great, that kind of question. So I guess I'm a Matthew 25 Christian at heart, and it's a long list of vulnerable populations that Jesus asks us all to be on the side of. In fact, he asks us to see himself in them, right? And doesn't ask us to choose between them, far from it, to think of them all together. And that's one of the primary pedagogical things that I think can come out for Christians, particularly about a new way of seeing the abortion issue is through the lens of multiple vulnerable populations. As you said, the seamless garment consistently protecting and supporting vulnerable populations, consistently resisting violence as a solution to problems, consistently being willing to give both individual and structural support to these vulnerable populations. And it turns out at the end of the day that that is not only just the right thing to do theologically and ethically, it is actually also the politically right thing to do. It is the thing that, especially the United States, will get you broad support if you do the two things together. And unbelievably, it's also the thing in the United States, I think the way I read abortion jurisprudence as coming down, especially from Justice Kennedy, who is the swing vote on the court, it's also the thing that makes sense legally. The more support we give to women, and we should just give support to women, period, as a matter of justice, but the more support you give to women, the more Justice Kennedy and maybe even one or two others, it's hard to read, the more that certainly the swing vote on the court would look at a particular law as not being an undue burden on women, which is currently the constitutional test for whether an abortion law is constitutional. So legally, politically, ethically, theologically, to see and react to and serve and protect vulnerable populations together, I think is the primary way we need to think about this.
Well, as constructive and as fascinating as this has all been, we do have to wrap up. It's been another longer show. But, you know, we only have guests on from Fordham every so often, so we don't mind. One last order of business before we wrap up. Some of you, last episode we issued a bit of a call or an invitation to help partner with us by supporting, donating some cash so that we can get some better equipment, microphones, so this doesn't sound so bootleg and so forth. And we were overwhelmed at the response that we've actually gotten. The generosity has been so wonderful. And so we just wanted to say thank you. We're looking at ways of issuing more personal thank yous, but we just wanted to start off by saying thank you. We also still would love for people to continue to maybe consider a small gift or donation. We really are just trying to get some of the costs covered and improve the quality in order to give a, you know, better experience for the listeners and the quality for the show. So thank you. And then also if you would like us to, if some of you would like us to thank you, there's another opportunity for that, because we still do need some cash. So thanks for participating. Charlie, thanks for coming on the show with us. This was fantastic. Great discussion. And yeah, guys, this is an important issue. We will have a link to his book, Beyond the Abortion Wars. I'm sure you'll all be interested in picking it up. I am. So I hope that's an encouragement for you guys to go ahead and dive into this really important issue. So we're going to wrap it up here. Say thanks for listening. If you felt like this helped, feel free to share. Blessings.